So there might be a little bit missing in that audio recording, but... Okay, so here we go, once again. So this is the audio recording. And I was just starting on an aside, because if... This is the funny thing about learning in networks. Remember I talked about we have our network, we have our connections of neurons, and these connections form and strengthen or weaken by the experience. Well, we only have one neural network in our mind, right? Our brain is one big neural network. That means our experiences layer over on top of each other. We form some connections, we form some new connections, we form some new connections, which means that our connections of different concepts are all wrapped up together in the same network. It becomes very complicated. We might see a horse, we see certain few connect, we form some connections when we see the horse. Then we might see a palm tree, and we form connections over those very same connections. So all of our experiences are feeding into this same web of connections. And this web of connections becomes very complex. We'll come back to that. Still no internet. Okay? So... is probably, well, you might get most of it. It's not going to go all the way to the end because it did not load completely, but we should begin to see some of this effect even, so now you can see they're rotating or they're vibrating very differently. Look at that. And they start to move back and forth in sync. It's the principle of synchronicity in action. Pretty neat effect, eh? It's simple physics, simple mathematics. Nothing complicated. No grand theory, meaning of life, construction, simple physics. And our brain is a very complex mechanism, but at its core, it is very simple. One neuron connects to another neuron. One neuron sends a signal to another neuron. Society is very complex. We form nations, we build telephone systems and power systems, but society is very simple. One person talks to another person. One person gives something to another person. That's the core of what society is. We build complex things out of simple parts. And so if we understand what the simple parts are, we understand the mechanisms of how we can build complex things. All right. And we'll stop that. Okay. Let's pop up here to the PowerPoints again. So... the principles of association that I describe, they look like theory, but they are simple mechanical physical principles. In learning, in connectivist learning, we think of ourselves as nodes, as entities in this network. Teachers, students, we're the same thing. We're a node or an entity in the network. We receive communications and we send communications. And now one for the photographer. I love doing that. Except I try to time it so that, you know. So that's where aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward comes from. It's an approach that invites you to imagine that you are a node in a network. You are like a neuron. You are like a single entity connected to other entities. You receive signals from other entities. You aggregate. You process them. You remix them. You add your own elements to them. A neuron does very simple things. A neuron will receive signals and the electrical potential will build and build and build and build, and then at a certain point it'll fire. And then it'll do it again. Humans are more complex. We process input differently. We send out different kinds of signals. But it's the same underlying mechanism. A metronome on a piece of wood receives input from the piece of wood from other metronomes, and its internal physics adjusts to that input, and then its output is fed forward to other metronomes. It's the same mechanism. A cricket chirps. It hears other crickets chirping. And there's a simple mathematical principle that will cause it to slow down its chirping until it's chirping in synchronization with other crickets. The same principle, the same mathematics, the same physics that governs the metronomes, governs the crickets chirping, governs our neurons, governs us acting in a social network. That's the underlying theory of connectivism. That's why we say aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward. Aggregate, gather resources from wherever they may be. Remix, to do mashups, to put things together, to join. Repurpose, to localize, adapt, markup, tag, do lip dubs, whatever. And then feed forward as video, slides, graphics, text, whatever. It's also a way of thinking of learning as immersion. If you think of yourself as a node in a network, the way you are learning is you are immersed in that network. You are experiencing the things that other members of the network are experiencing. You're doing the same things that other people in the network do. If you're learning to be a pilot, for example, learning by immersion is learning in a flight simulator and then learning in an airplane. Imagine simply being told how to fly an airplane. Makes no sense. You need to be immersed in an airplane. Connectivism is a theory of immersive learning. Here's an example of learning as immersion. People working together in a network of connected one laptop per child computers. The One Laptop Per Child initiative was a project that gave computers to school children around the world. And it was launched by Nicholas Negroponte, who was at MIT, the same place Seymour Papert was. And it's informed by the same connectionist principles. And the thinking here behind one laptop per child is that you want to have these children join in and become a network. And they will learn by being immersed in this network and sending communications back and forth. The One Laptop Per Child program received a lot of criticism because it did not come with instructional design and pedagogy and big guides for teachers to tell them how to teach and pass content along. The purpose of the program was simply put computers into children's hands, put the capacity to communicate into children's hands, and to create into children's hands, and they will learn. There's an initiative by a guy called Sugrata Mitra. I'd look it up, but I don't have the internet. It's the Hole in the Wall project. It's a great project. Well, maybe I do have internet now. We'll just check and see. Don't know. Oh, that looks hopeful. There we go. Sugata Mitra. And his project was simply, and he did this in India, put a computer into a hole in a wall with some plexiglass in front of it so nobody would steal it, and then made the keyboard available so people could type on it, and then left it there. And the children in the neighborhood started playing with the computer, and they taught themselves how to use the computer all by themselves. And this is an experiment he's repeated over and over again. And there's he's spoken about this. There's a here's the TED video, and I'm not going to play the TED video because it's too long and because our video bandwidth is a bit uncertain. But it's the same principle again. Learning by immersion, and when you're immersed in an environment, you are able to employ that principle of self-organization that I demonstrated with the metronomes. Learning by immersion is the same thing as being in a network and synchronizing and self-organizing. Now that we're back online, let's start the broadcast again. And those of you on Ed Radio, welcome back. We are back. Sorry about that. We had audio dropout. We had an internet dropout, but now we're back. And I don't know if there's anyone online now because they may have all left, but oh well. And we'll check Twitter again. Results for Ed Radio. No results for Ed Radio. Yeah, right. I tell you, they broke Twitter when they changed it. There we go. And nothing new on the Twitter. Okay. So you're all with me so far? How's it going so far? Yeah? See what I'm doing, right? Feedback. Back propagation. Yeah, I know. Everybody knows feedback. Seymour Papert was very important in network learning and learning by immersion. And those of you who are familiar with Seymour Papert are familiar with the theory of constructionism. And it's the same theory, the same model, and we're just viewing it from a different perspective. And the idea of constructionism is essentially, at its simplest and most basic formulation, learning by creating things, learning by constructing things. This is why Papert was involved with projects like Squeak and Scratch, and the idea was that children could learn logical concepts by programming computers in simple programming languages. And this is the same model again in connectivism. We talk about being a node in a network, but why is this important? It is important because we are engaging in this practice. We get signals in, we remix, we repurpose, we feed forward, but what we're doing through this process of creation is building our neural network. We're forming these connections. It's have you seen The Karate Kid? The old one, not the new one. The new one's not bad, but the old one was the good one. And it's kind of a silly thing. The karate kid wants to learn karate, so he goes to the master. And the master, I want to learn karate. And the master says, good, wash my car. And so the kid washes the car. And the master said, no, not that way. Rub on, rub off. Rub on, rub off. And the kid washes the car. Rub on, rub off. Rub on, rub off. The next day, wash my car. Rub on, rub off. Wash it day after day. And what's happening is through this act, this not so creative act of washing the car, the child is building automatic mental connections, neural connections. And then later, the kid eventually finally says, this is stupid. I want to learn karate, but you're not teaching me about karate. You're teaching me to wash the car. And the master says, defend yourself. And the master goes, huh. And the kid goes, shh, rub on. The master goes, huh. And the kid goes, shh, rub off. Aha, that's how you defend yourself. And the idea here was through this practice to build this instinctive defensive response. Again, it's very different than transmitting content, isn't it? What we're trying to do in connectivism is to stimulate practice through washing cars or whatever that result in the growth of a neural network. And in the case of the Karate Kid, it's a very simple, not very complex example of automatic reaction. If you read Dreyfus and Dreyfus, they talk about who an expert is, what constitutes expert knowledge. What is expert knowledge? You think about it. Expert knowledge is automatic intuitive knowledge. It's knowing what to do before you even know why you know what to do. It's reacting right. It's acting by intuition. It's being able to see, to recognize. Expert knowledge, you know, if you think about what is expert knowledge when you're driving a car, it's reacting and not analyzing and processing. Expert knowledge is knowledge that is connections between neurons, strong connections between neurons, so you don't think. There's not a cognitive process, it's a process of becoming. All this other stuff, building or creating or constructing meaning, projecting identity, absorbing facts, all of these are intended to try to scaffold you to this expert knowledge. But the expert knowledge itself is not any of these things. So far, so good? That was part one. You see why I want to show first and talk about theory later? Because yesterday you saw the practice, the environment, and now today so far we've seen the theory about why we built that environment. Now I want to talk a bit, we're running a bit behind, but we're okay. I want to talk a bit how to understand this. I want to talk about how we, as people observing the learning process, observing the process of aggregation, remix, repurpose, feed forward, should understand this. Because we want to break out of this idea that learning is transmission of information into content and that is remembered. And we want to be thinking and understanding for ourselves of learning as this process of communication from one node to another node in a network. This is important because we need to understand as educators that everything a person does is a learning experience. Everything a person does is an instance of aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward. Think about it. There's nothing you do that is not one of these things. You are learning all the time. You are teaching all the time. It's a question of understanding what it is we're learning, what we're teaching. Let me give you an example. Because when we talk about learning, we tend to privilege the sentential form. We privilege sentences. We privilege propositions. We think of learning as like a book. And a book is like text, and a text is like language, and language is linear. And language is textual, and language has subjects and objects and verbs and all of that. People online don't work that way. The children, teens, youths, young adults, old adults, me, are beginning to communicate in very different, non-linear, non-propositional ways. What I'm showing here is an example of a lolcat. What I talked about lolcats on Monday, and nobody knew what I meant, which is fine. Lolcats are a scream. They're very funny. You can look them up yourself. Just type lolcats in Google search, and you will go to a site called ICANN Has Cheeseburger, which is the original lolcat site. And maybe I'll go to the historical lolcats so that we see some of the early ones. And sorry, I'm looking for a very specific lolcat, but nah, I'm not going to find it just off. So we'll go to ICANN Has Cheeseburger. Here we go. So what we have here is a picture of a cat and some text written on top of the picture of the cat. This text says, "Of course I'm snide. Did you even bother to read the owner's manual?" Okay. To some people, not to everybody, this is funny. This is hilarious. That's why they're called LOL, L-O-L, stands for laugh out loud, cats. And there's more. And there's more. "We heard you like cats. We heard you like memes." And there's more. "This is not a cat, it's a raccoon." "You did so get your driver's license out of a Cracker Jack box." And we're getting some sound adjustments here. A video. Now here's one for the teachers. You just want it closer. Okay. "I can explain it to you, but I can't understand it for you." That's an interesting one. I like that one. There's one without a caption. And I could go on. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these. Think about what's going on here. You have a picture and you have some text. Now, what the person is doing who's creating a lolcat is typical connectivist activity. They are bringing things together and they're remixing them, picture and text. The text is very often a slogan or a saying that we've heard from somewhere else. You got your license from a Cracker Jack box, things like that. But more importantly, the lolcat says something new by combining these things together. And even more importantly, it says something different to each person who views the picture. The meaning of this picture depends not simply on the content, but on the receiver. So if you know about cats, and if you know that they're snide, and if you know that the word snide means standoffish, rude, having an attitude, I'm better than you, you know that that's typical cat behavior, so you think this is funny. But then there's the owner's manual idea, and you think about, you know, instructions on how to have a cat, and then you, as the viewer, associate in your own mind computer manual and cat, and that's funny. Or maybe not, it depends on who you are. But the whole process is this principle of association. It's creating a little network out of ideas to foster thinking in our own mind. It's a way of communicating through association. It's not a sentence. If you asked me, what is the meaning of this? There's no one answer. If you ask me to transmit the content of this from me to you, well, I can do the transmitting, but I can't do the understanding. That's just an accident. It just happens to be there. But it's a great image for this point. So it's a different language. It's a different way of communicating. It's a different way of thinking of communicating. It is not subject, verb, object. It's not this does that to that. It's an association. And then you draw whatever meaning from it makes sense to you. And so we have lolcats. And people communicate using them. Here's a very famous lolcat. It's not really that funny, especially these days. Now, you might not know the context. You might. But that person there, he has come to be known as Tourist Guy, is standing on top of the World Trade Center. Presumably this is sometime in 2001, well, September 2001, because there's an airplane. So we're seeing irony here. We're combining, and what the author of this one has done is combined an ordinary tourist's photo with a photo of an airplane to make an ironic statement. And this picture now will have different meanings to different people. I remember I went to New York, I visited New York for the first time, when was it? In 2000. And it was my first time in New York. I walk around a bit, and I'm thinking I should go visit the World Trade Center. But it's busy. I'm busy. And I think, well, I'll be back. It'll still be there. I'll visit the World Trade Center the next time I visit New York. Well, the next time I visited New York, there was just a big hole in the ground. So that's what this picture says to me, right? Tourist guy. Just your ordinary tourist photo, but now you can't do that anymore because of the airplane. I show this. I've used this photo in presentations in the United States, and it's funny because I show this slide, and you can hear the gasp in the room. It's like, how could you? It's 10 years, it's still not funny. It's like the comedian saying, yeah, too soon, eh? Americans react to this very differently than Canadians. Canadians think this is hilarious. Americans, not so much. So I skipped very quickly to the next slide. Speaking of lolcats, here's tourist guy again. But now he's standing in front of the Hindenburg disaster. Now you see what's happening here, right? It's become what they call a meme. M-E-M-E. It's an idea that propagates from communication to communication. We're communicating using memes. And so now there's a thread, a connection being drawn between one disaster and another disaster. Putting tourist guy in this picture draws a connection between the Hindenburg and the World Trade Center. It draws that connection in your mind. So you don't even need to have the... And think about how you understand the meaning of this. You do not even need to have the picture of the World Trade Center there. You have tourist guy and the Hindenburg. That's it. But the meaning is to connect with the World Trade Center. You, as a viewer, need to see both of these and draw the connection between them in your own mind in order to understand the meaning. And you have to have certain background or cultural assumptions. And as these background or cultural assumptions change, your understanding of this will change. But it's a feedback process, because this is also changing your background or cultural assumptions. You may have thought of 9/11, and most Americans do, right? 9/11 changed everything. 9/11 was the worst disaster ever in human history. But then you see this picture, and now your culture is changing. 9/11 was a disaster like other disasters, like the Hindenburg. You see how your understanding is beginning to change. No sentences have been spoken. No words have been spoken. There is no propositional knowledge here. There's no knowledge to transfer. It makes no sense to talk about knowledge transfer in this context. Here's another lolcat. There's tourist guy. And he's back on the World Trade Center again. You can sort of see the wing of the airplane. And there's Kanye West. And now this meaning is being drawn out even more clearly. You might not be able to read that, so I'm going to read it for you. This is Kanye West speaking. Yo, I'm going to let you finish, but Pearl Harbor was the greatest attack on America ever. By this time, when I'm doing this in the United States, by this time the audience is ready to kill me. But now the point is being made. There's a bunch of disasters, and we're not even sure we want to say that the World Trade Center was the worst disaster. And what makes this funny, I don't know, and again, there's a lot of context that's involved here. There was the music awards, I forget which ones, and Taylor Swift won an award for the best album, or no, the best music video. And as she's getting her award on the stage in front of all of the audience, Kanye West walked up, grabbed the microphone out of her hand, and said, yo, I'm gonna let you finish, but the Beyonce video was the best video ever. And then gave the microphone back to Taylor Swift, who had just won the award for best video. So, if you are in the culture of people who watch video awards or have heard about them, Now you're drawing the association between this rude Kanye West behavior and this statement that 9/11 is the worst disaster of all time. And now the meaning is becoming multi-layered and very complex. And I can tell by your reaction that the meaning is becoming complex enough that you're almost losing the thread, right? Am I right? Yeah. It's because immersion and being situated in this conversation is absolutely crucial to understanding the conversation. We speak in many different languages. We don't just use words. We don't just use audio and video. Everything we do is a way of communicating. We have body language. You see me sitting here, my hands are going crazy, right? This is my body language. But even, you know, and there are, in different cultures, different standards. Like the woman on the side, lying? Is she lying? Am I lying? Am I believable if I'm talking like this? If I gave my whole talk like this, it would be a different message, wouldn't it? It would not be the same. Or the guy there, right? Suppose I gave my talk like this. Oops. There's somebody. Now I am going to tell you about body language. Different message, right? Everything we do is communication. Everything instructors do, everything students do. And we see, we are seeing, and that's why this is relevant now, an explosion of this on the internet. But it's nothing new. Clothing. People say different things with their clothing. People say different things with cloth, with uniforms, with flags, with drapes. I noticed, and I found this very interesting, probably shouldn't just go off on asides like this, but I do. But I'm sort of giving you a glimpse into the way I think, too, here. And I think this is it. I hope it's here. Well, this might not be the one. Oh, maybe it's not here. Oh, I haven't uploaded this yet. Oh, too bad. Okay. Well, do you remember on Monday? How many of you were there for the talk on Monday? A few? Okay. There's the big stage. It's in the auditorium over in the other room. You'll notice I am pointing in the right direction. Everything you do is a communication. If I pointed like that, instead of like that, those of you who are geographically aware would know that I'm not geographically aware. By pointing in the correct location, those of you who are geographically aware know that I am geographically aware. We have made a communication. The big stage, and then there was this big orange cloth hung from the ceiling. Just decoration? Maybe, or maybe it isn't. Even this stage, the same flowers from Monday. These are the same flowers from Monday. I recognize them. Right? This is interesting, the meaning. There is meaning to these flowers. There is meaning to that big drape. I'll tell you what I saw. I looked at the drape, the big orange cloth hanging from the ceiling, and to me, it was similar to, so there's Hebbian association, a sash that you wear. So the big drape hanging from the ceiling symbolized to me that this was a formal location. The stage was dressed up with a sash. Now, maybe your association is different because you have different meanings, and I don't know what the meaning of the color would be. could be anything, although I did notice it matched the color of the flowers. So somebody thought about the color. The meaning, you know, even these flowers, what do these flowers say? These flowers say something about the specialness of the occasion. You get two flowers, not just one. Balance, harmony, whatever. Everything says something. None of this is new. Many people have said this before me. And there's a whole field of semiotics. Other ways we speak, through maps, through diagrams, through graphics, again, none of these have a sentential form. We learn from these by experiencing them. We learn from these by associating them with real-world phenomena, with real-world objects. I was in a place called Kakadu in Australia, in northern Australia. And I was able to see cave paintings on a wall in Kakadu. And there's a cave painting. What that is, it's kind of hard to see. You have to interpret it a bit. You have to think like an Australian Aboriginal. And it's a fish. It's not just a fish. It's a fish that has been opened up and gulleted. And you ask, why did an Aboriginal 10,000 years ago paint a picture of an open and gulleted fish on a wall in a cave? And the answer is to communicate. To communicate what? To communicate how to clean a fish. How do you clean a fish? Look, there. But it wouldn't be so obvious. You can imagine the scene 10,000 years ago. We're Aboriginals. We have our little fire. We're by the cave. We've just got some fish. I'm cutting open some fish. My child is there. My child sees me, sees the picture. Sees me, sees the picture. Every day, sees me, sees the picture, and learns how to clean a fish. By looking at me, by looking at the picture. The picture, the similarity, the identity, the association between the picture and the fish means that the picture is used to teach how to prepare a fish. For many people, this is a very funny video. For other people, nobody knows what it means. This demonstrates that our understanding of these many different languages depends on context, depends on connections, depends on associations. Again, this is why you cannot simply transmit content. The representation of content in text or in language is the barest abstract, the tiniest peak of meaning. And most of the meaning is hidden. When I say a sentence, Paris is the capital of France, only the smallest bit of my knowledge is represented in that sentence. And all the rest of what I mean when I'm trying to say when I say that sentence is hidden. And so the only way I can get you to understand what I mean when I say Paris is the capital of France is to try to convince you to place yourself in the same situation that I'm in, to immerse yourself in my community, and we will all talk about Paris and France. We'll have pictures of the Eiffel Tower, and we'll make jokes about Valerie D'Estaing, Gerard D'Estaing, or Charles de Gaulle, or whatever. And we will have a shared cultural association about France created through this network of communications. And then when I say Paris is the capital of France, all of these associations come to your mind, and you sort of begin to get what I'm up to. Sort of. It's never identical. There's a contrast between old media and new media that parallels the contrast between old-style teaching and new-style teaching. The old style of teaching is that messages have a sender and a receiver. There's somebody who says something, who transmits, or somebody else who receives. New style thinking, there might be a sender, there might be a receiver, we don't know, who cares, it might not even be a message, we don't even think of it that way. What is the practical implication of that? Well, I'll show you. Right now, I am broadcasting on Ed Radio. Message sender, message received. We are going to change the translator. Oh, okay. All right. So here I am on Ed Radio sending the message. But let's go to the Ed Radio webpage. So, where is it here? We have to go. I'm quite sure this will work out. As long as we have internet. Here's the Ed Radio page. So now Ed Radio, remember from yesterday, is my broadcast, my webcast. So I'm sending audio out there onto the internet. And this picture here, and I'll actually open this. This frame, show only this frame. So here we go. Here's the picture of the world. There is nobody listening to my broadcast on Ed Radio. Not one person. I was pretty sure of that. There we go. In the entire world, not one person is listening to Ed Radio. But I'm still broadcasting. There's a message, there's a sender, but there's no receiver. But there's still communication happening. Because the act of communicating is an act that helps me, informs me, tells me about my world, but also is an act of communicating to other people, even though nobody's listening. You might think this is really stupid. Give me a better example. Okay, here's a better example. This is a concrete, practical example. And you'll begin to see. In 1995, I moved from Alberta, which is a province in Western Canada, to a small city called Brandon, Manitoba. And in Brandon, I've been there now, I was living there 3 or 4 months, and it's time to have an election for the mayor. And there's the incumbent mayor, Rick Baratzik was his name. He was running for re-election, and nobody was going to run against him. He was going to be, as they say, acclaimed, because he was the only one running. And I looked at this, and I said, well, that can't be. So I decided to run for mayor. Even though I have no possible chance of winning. So there's a message, but there's not going to be any receiver. I have no hope of having success. It will be a failure. I've only lived in the city for 3 or 4 months. But the act of running for mayor, even though there was no possibility of success, still had meaning. And in Brandon, ever since then, the elections for mayor, there's always more than one candidate. I was defeated. I got 11% of the vote, which I thought was pretty impressive for somebody who's been there for 3 months. So, yeah, it's okay to send messages when there's no receiver. It's okay when your words will not be received. The act of sending them is by itself a message. We need to rethink what it means to communicate. It's not just sender, receiver. It's this whole environment in which the whole act of communication has, in which this act of communication takes place. Another conception. Words get meaning from what they represent. The idea that your communication stands for something, or represents something, or refers to something. The whole idea of constructing meaning is an old idea. Words, bottles, everything has meaning, but this meaning may be derived from any number of different sources. This was an example, now it's water. The connection between the word and the reference is very loose. So loose we can almost ignore it. The meaning, I don't want to say the meaning is built by the listener, because that's not what happens. The meaning varies from person to person, varies from context to context, and meanings change and grow as a person changes and grows. Truth is based on the real world. That's an old way of thinking. And that's not to say that the real world does not play a role. The real world plays a role. It matters. But truth is not, you know, look at the lolcats that I put up. Tourist guy standing on top of the World Trade Center with an airplane in the back. Was that true or was that false? It does not even make sense to ask the question. Events have a cause and events can be known is an old way of thinking. That's not to say there are no causes, but it is to say that causation is very complex and you cannot reduce it down to something simple. It depends on your perspective, on your point of view. A philosopher called Norwood Russell Hansen said, or he asked, what is the cause of the car accident? And the driver will say, the other car was in the way. The road designer will say, the corner was too sharp. The psychologist will say, he was distracted. Any event has multiple causes. Bas van Frassen, on the subject of explanation, says, why do the roses grow in the yard? One answer, because they won't grow on the pavement. Another answer, because somebody planted the rose seeds. Another answer, because they were watered every day. Another answer, because this is the planet Earth and it has air and ground and a sun. There's no such thing as a simple explanation for a simple cause. Those of you who are involved in curriculum evaluation need to reflect on the truth of this. Because the very traditional way of evaluating the success of learning is to have an experimental situation where you have a class, an intervention, and then you measure for a result. And you have a control group without the intervention, and you measure for a result. And this is the classic experimental method, and you are attempting to assess the impact of the intervention. You are trying to find a cause for an improvement in learning. But the environment that you're attempting to assess is too complex to be able to reliably depend on an experiment of that design. An experiment of that design, for example, involves holding all other factors constant. For example, people talk about introducing computers to the classroom and measuring the effect of a computer in a classroom. So you have one classroom with computers and another classroom without computers, right? And you measure your results. But outside the classroom, the students go out and they talk to each other. And the students with the computers talk to the students without the computers and they tell them how great it was. Or they pass the answer to each other. Or the students without the computer go home and use the computer at home. Or the students with the computer are used to using a computer but are a different kind of computer. Or the students with the computer use a computer at home all the time, but they have Twitter at home, but they don't have Twitter at the school. You see all the different ways the results of that experiment, that very simple experiment, can vary due to factors outside the experiment. The whole world is like this. There's no simple cause. There's no simple explanation. There's no simple test for an outcome. People do these experiments in a class all the time. Did the student learn that Paris was the capital of France? And the way they measure the result, they ask the student, what is the capital of France? And the student answers, Paris. What they don't do is they ask, what is Paris? Because the student might not even know that Paris is a city. And yet they will succeed, they will pass the test, if they answer correctly, Paris is the capital of France. They can learn the form without learning all of the context. This old media picture, this old knowledge picture, this old learning picture forms a static, linear, coherent picture of the world as though it were a book or a library. But language is not like that, learning is not like that, and media is not like that. So how do we change our thinking? Let's stop thinking of educational resources as content to be learned. Instead of thinking of resources as though we're going to transfer the content into a person's brain, let's start thinking of educational resources as language, like pictures, like clothing, flags, maps, as objects that we will pass back and forth to each other. It doesn't matter what the object says. It's a hard concept. How can you teach a math class without caring about the content? But really, all you are doing in a math class is you are creating and sharing math objects. It doesn't matter whether it's a math trigonometry object, whether it's a math algebra object, whether it's a math calculus object, whether it's a math, whatever object. The idea here is to use math objects as a language. Have people throw them back and forth, create, manipulate, aggregate, etc. It's to give people math as something to play with instead of something to learn. And this is the basis behind John Holt when he talks about the rods for teaching math. Because mathematics, in this example, becomes something that you play with. It's just a bunch of rods you play with, you put together, you form areas, you form lines, whatever. Math becomes a type of play instead of this body of theory. Math becomes a language you can communicate with instead of something you have to remember. Does that make sense? And math is the hard example. Right? The easy examples, take history, right? You teach history, the traditional teaching of history, teach a series of events and a series of dates. And then in more advanced history, you start talking about why did an event happen? Why did Napoleon invade Russia? And then in traditional learning, there's an answer, right? There's an explanation. He invaded Russia because. But if we think of the history of Napoleon as something to play with, then learning becomes immersing the person in that history. And there are many ways to immerse a person in that history. Because there are many ways to use historical objects as language objects. You can put them in a museum and have them see the uniforms. You can have them read War and Peace. You can have them have a play where one person acts as Napoleon and another person acts as Alexander. You can have them play a video game. I used to play a game called Empires in Arms all the time. Great game. It's not even a computer game. It's a board game. You have little cardboard pieces and you play it. Anyhow, fabulous game. You can have them play a simulation. You can have them join a discussion group where they talk about Napoleonic subjects. I was in a discussion group. They don't seem to exist anymore. I was in a discussion group once where every member of the discussion group contributed not as themselves, but as a historical figure. So you have to try to act like the person from history. None of it, and the idea here is we're not trying to teach them about the history, we're trying to immerse them in the history. And importantly, the success or failure of this method is not measured by whether they remembered certain facts about history, because their understanding does not consist in that. I'll have to talk about what that success is, and that's one of the sections. But it's important to separate the learning from the information. So far, so good? We can actually understand and talk about this language. I won't linger on this because this is a whole subject in itself. But if we want to talk intelligently about plants on the stage, or the color of the walls, or the clothes that people wear, or lolcats, or a math example, then we need to understand the different ways that we can look at these objects in language. And so I've created a frame here for understanding new media. It's just a frame. It's just a way of looking at language. It's not definitive. It's not absolute truth. It's a context, a way of dialogue. Does that make? Yeah, I hope that makes sense. See, by now, this is an aside. By now, it should be clear that what I present here should not be accepted as truth based on what I've already said. What I present here is my perspective on the phenomena I've observed. It doesn't even make sense to say, am I right, am I wrong? What you are getting from me is the result of my experiences, my working with my experiences and trying to understand them, and then my projection of my experiences to you. And then you take my experience and put it into your own frame, put it into your own context, and apply it or not apply it however you wish. And the question of truth, am I right, am I wrong, is not even relevant in this context. So, That's how you should understand this frame. It's not the way to understand language, all languages, but just one way. So, if we think about the flowers on the stage, think about the syntax of flowers. What does the flower represent? Is it an archetype? Is there a way of putting flowers on the stage? Is there a way of arranging flowers? What are the operations, the procedures for putting flowers on a stage? Is there a process that you have to follow? Somebody probably ordered them, and there's probably a whole thing about paying for them. The flowers don't just arrive. The big flowers go in the center, and the small flowers go on the outside. It would look weird to us, wouldn't it, if the small flowers were in the middle and the big flowers were on the outside? It would say something completely different. Are there patterns? Are there regularities? Notice these two are the same. Not exactly the same, but they're kind of the same. Are there similarities? These are ways of understanding, of thinking about these communications. Semantics. What do the flowers mean? What do they refer to, if anything? What do they denote, if anything? How should we interpret it? How are the flowers associated with other things? How do the flowers influence how we decide to do things? Simple things like the route that I'll take. You know, and think about it. This is one way of understanding these flowers. As a way of guiding people when they walk onto the stage. They don't want me to walk into the table, so they put flowers in front of the table. The stage design. There's a guy, you'll love this. I've forgotten his name, that's why. Dan Lochten has a fascinating blog, and it's called Design with Intent. It used to be called Architectures of Control in Design. And it's all about how people use design to control outcomes. And once you've read this for a while, you begin to see this all over the place. Have you ever seen, there's somebody has a low wall outside a building, they put little spikes on the wall, and you wonder why they do that, is to prevent people from sitting on the wall. They don't want people sitting on the wall around their building. I don't know why. There's all kinds of design, rules, regulations, patterns, regularities that you can use to control, you know, traffic flow. So people put flowers on stages sometimes to control traffic. It's another way of interpreting the meaning or the purpose of these flowers. Pragmatics. How are things used? How do you use things to do things? Think about the way people use words. Words sometimes do not just express meaning. Words are used to actually perform some function. Every one of you who has married someone has used a word to perform an act. Do you da 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 da? Yes, I do. When you say I do, you're not just expressing an opinion. You're actually committing yourself to an act. So you can do things with words. You can do things with any kind of communication. If I walk into this room in a policeman's uniform, I'm doing something very different than if I walk in with this shirt on. All of these communications are not just expressions of content, but they're actual actions that are being taken. You can ask questions. I'm trying to think of how we could ask a question with these flowers. If I picked up that flower and gave it to somebody, that could be interpreted as a question. Could be. Depends. You know, the meaning of the flowers depends on how I use the flowers. Cognition. How are we drawing inferences with our language? How are we arriving at conclusions? I'm not sure how we would use a flower to arrive at a conclusion, but I'm sure if I thought about it long enough, I could come up with one. But we use the different types of language to suggest conclusions and to draw conclusions. The associations we draw, the connections we make in our mind, are also inferences. They're also discoveries. When we perceive a pattern in our environment, we have also drawn a conclusion about our environment. Context, placement, environment, explanation, meaning, we've talked about these, vocabulary. The meaning of a word depends on what other words are available. If you think about the meaning of color words, and this is I don't know if you have the same thing here in Mexico, but we have it in Canada. It's kind of funny. If you ask the husband what color is the wall, the husband will say white. If you ask the wife what color is the wall, the wife will say, oh, that's eggshell. If you show the husband five patches of color, the husband will say, that's white, that's white, that's white, that's white, that's white. If you show the wife five colors, that's eggshell, that's cream, that's paper, that's cloud, and that's cotton. Right? You do have that here, don't you? Yeah. If you ask the husband, how many choices of colors do you have to paint the wall? The husband says, one, white. If you ask the wife, there are five different choices. Now, ask the husband and ask the wife, what is the meaning of the word white? Well, the meaning of the word depends on what the other choices are, doesn't it? And everybody, through their different experiences, has different ranges of alternative choices. Words, objects, communications of all sorts are used, as George Lakoff would say, to frame these choices. Again, it's a way of interpreting or understanding the world. One of the things George Lakoff says about United States politics, he talks about the right wing in United States politics. And what they do is they recruit and promote very extreme right wing points of view. And today they have the Tea Party, which is a very right wing kind of, and it doesn't matter what they believe or don't believe. It's just they are further to the right. And the Republicans are promoting this not because they believe these things, but because it used to be the choice left-right. But now the choice is left-right, extreme right. And the meaning of right has changed, right? The meaning of right used to mean one thing, now it means something else. It used to be left, right, you could just choose. Now, left, right, extreme right, people like to go for the middle. You create a new middle by creating a new extreme. That's one of the reasons why I ran for mayor in Brandon. Not because I would win, but because I wanted to reframe politics in the city. I wanted to create a new alternative quite a bit further over where there was none before, and then other people followed. They were much more moderate, but now that position is acceptable. Context changes meaning. But you can use language, water bottles, flowers, whatever, to change context. So you can actually change the meaning of one word by talking about something completely different. Finally, change. Marshall McLuhan talked a lot about change and the impact of change. What does the new thing replace? What does it create? What does it make obsolete? We express change in our communications. We express directionality. Traditional text-based language has a very linear directional flow. A photograph, like a lolcat, does not, but it implies change in a different way. Think about how we use objects to manage time, to manage our progression, manage our flow. Street design is a lot like that. You look at the way they design streets, that's all about managing change, because traffic is dynamic, and you're managing a flow. And if you're thinking about how to design a street, you're trying to think about, how is this traffic going to move? Is traffic like water? Is traffic like sand? Is traffic like bricks falling? Different kinds of flow, different kinds of change. These languages are, how do I want to say this? People often talk, when they talk about 21st century learning, as skills in learning how to use computers, skill, typical cognitive skills, performance, simulation, appropriation. To me, those are just words. Who cares what the words mean? But all of these things can be understood in terms of these six dimensions. Take performance, for example. Whatever that is, performance. There's a whole cognitive semiotic story to tell about performance. The whole identity as performance kind of thing. We can understand performance in terms of this frame as having elements of syntax, semantics, pragmatics, cognition, context, and change. That's a way to understand how performance is used in communication. And so we'll look at one of the boxes in that frame. Think of the syntax of performance. The regularities involved in acting, the patterns involved in acting. Stanislavski's system, the method acting. A ritual performance, a mass in church. Comparing tales, telling stories. In Canada, we have the whole performance of sitting around a campfire and telling fish stories. And the idea is to tell the story about the biggest fish. And of course, the story always ends, and then the fish got away. Okay, it's a lot funnier in Canada. I think context matters. Okay, so we're at 12:30, I think. Let's take 10 minutes, and then I'd like to talk about success factors, and then, and very briefly, applying this to your own learning. So going from to the success factors to the actual practice of learning in this connectivist model. Does that sound good? All right, 10 minutes then. And for those of you listening on Ed Radio, as before, well, there is nobody listening on Ed Radio, but I'm still going to play you some music. Oh, and those of you listening on audio, we're on pause. Okay, and now we should be recording again in Audacity. And maybe or maybe not. Alright, and so this picks up the Audacity recording. So most of the audio from this talk will be recorded, and again, you'll be able to retrieve that from my website sometime later today or tomorrow, depending. We do have one person listening, so hello, listener. And if you would like to communicate with us here in the room, we invite you to use Twitter, if Twitter is functioning. It wasn't when I looked at it last, but it appears to be functioning now. And use the tag EdRadio. Use the hashtag EdRadio. So that's the hash mark and then the phrase EdRadio. And I'm playing or showing. Here we have somebody who's retweeted the announcement about the slides being available under the hashtag. So that's a useful thing right there. So I hope you're enjoying this. I know that this content is difficult. I think it's difficult anyways. If you think it's simple, wonderful, fabulous, that's great. I mean, you should go out and write a book. But I think it's hard content. I think it's difficult content. And if you're following and understanding what I'm saying as I go along, then I think you're being very successful. You should know by now, I don't expect you, I don't want you to remember all of this content, right? That's not what the intent is. That's not what I'm trying to do. What I'm doing here is, if you will, almost like a performance. I'm using words to do things. I'm trying to stimulate thoughts in you. And the important outcome of this event is the thoughts that you have. The thoughts that you have today, the thoughts that you have tomorrow, the echo or the ripple effect that you may have on your own work in the future. If you want to review the content, you always can. The content is there, and that'll help you stimulate further thoughts in the future. And if you feel that this was valuable, I certainly invite you to do that. But again, the educational achievement here is not the remembering of what Stephen said. It almost doesn't matter what Stephen said. What matters is what you take away from it. Do you think about these things the next time you do curricular design? Do some of these principles mesh with other principles in your mind to create new knowledge or new awareness? And this might not even be evident today. It might not be evident tomorrow. It might be a while. And only in the long run will we know whether this was successful. So for today, all I can hope for is interesting. So I hope you find it interesting. So let's go back to the slides. We've got the recording going. We've got EdRadio going. We've done the language, syntax. So let's think about what success is in a network environment. What do we even mean by success? What is a good network? What is a network that is reliable? What is good growth in ourselves? What is good learning? Now, it used to be, if you could memorize and then recite all the verses of the Bible, you would be considered as very learned. But today, we think of successful learning as something different. But it's really hard to get a handle on it. And we still kind of treat people with really large memories as though they're very learned. But we also know that there's this performance aspect to it. I talked a little bit about the expert and just being able to intuitively do something. But how does success relate back to the principle of networks. Well, there is a trend now in the field of online learning in the area of assessment and analytics. And I think that this trend is going to play a major role in the future. But I think we have to be very careful about how we design assessment and analytics, because there are different ways we could design these systems. On the one hand, there's always two hands. On the one hand, there is assessment analytics in the form of test grades or assignment grades, those sorts of traditional educational outcomes. On the other hand, if we look at how analytics are actually done on the World Wide Web in real world applications, very little of it has to do with tests. And rather, analytical engines look at who you talk to, how often you talk to, what websites you visit, how long you stay there, what you say, what words you use, how often you use them. Right, here's a typical analytic. And you've probably seen this. Oh, we got one new tweet. Very interesting. Oh, thank you, Victor. So, here's a very simple analytic. And it's called Wordle. And what Wordle does is, and it's going to be slow now, it takes a body of text, it makes a list of all the words in that text, and then it presents that list in an image. And the bigger the word is, the more frequently it was used. It's a very simple analytic. But it's a way of abstracting from the propositional content. This is a Wordle, interestingly. It says for English notebook cover. So the word English was used a lot, but so was the word wish. And so was the word climb. And it almost paints a picture for you, right? Learning English is about aspirations, about fulfilling wishes, about climbing. You get this sort of picture in your mind. So that's the output of one particular type of analytic. Oops, I didn't want to go back there. I'll just close this. We could say, and it's not on the slide, but we could say the old type of analytic of test results and things like that is a cognitive analytic. It's trying to test for the retaining of information. The new type of analytic is an interactive analytic, and we're measuring the frequency and the type of connections that we make with other people, with concepts, and with ideas. Let me explain. Remember I talked about personal knowledge and public knowledge earlier. Personal knowledge is the knowledge in our head, and public knowledge is the social network. The connections between people in a society and the communications they send back and forth. In connectivism, what we are doing is we are using a social network. That's the picture on the left, to create a personal network, where the personal network consists of these neural connections that I was talking about. And that's the model I've been describing so far, right? So we immerse ourselves in this public network. We immerse ourselves in a social network consisting of people who are talking about and working in whatever we want to learn. So we join the network. We aggregate, we remix, we repurpose, and we feed forward. We do all of these things in the network, and the reason to do this is to develop these connections in the mind. We learn English in our mind by speaking English with our friends. The learning outcome is complex. When we engage in a process of learning in a social network, we do not learn simple facts in isolation. We learn a large, complex set of interrelated and overlapping facts. And even that's a bad way of saying it. Because really what that means is we create a large and complex network. One way of characterizing this difference is to use the approach or use the terminology of Michael Polanyi, who wrote a book called Personal Knowledge. And it's the difference between knowing cognitively that Paris is the capital of France. In other words, defining this knowledge that we have externally in terms of some sort of set of words, and what it feels like to have geographical knowledge, what it feels like to speak a language. Our knowledge of a language, our knowledge that Paris is the capital of France, is a set of connections. It is not Paris is the capital of France. It is a set of connections, and so we do not, no, I'll say that differently. We feel our knowledge. We do not access our knowledge. That's such a hard concept to explain in words. It's almost not explainable in words. Learning a discipline, as the slide says, is a total state. You don't learn about physics. You become a physicist. You don't learn about aviation. You become a pilot. How do you know you're a pilot? Not because you know this, and this, but because when you sit down to fly a plane, you know what you're doing. Do you see the difference? So our learning outcomes, then, are these total states, and not a collection of specific states. Learning to be a pilot isn't simply learning to taxi, learning to take off, learning to fly, learning to land, learning to thank the passengers. It's not a series of individual competences, in other words. It's a total state. And as I said, obtained by immersion in this environment. And it is expressed not cognitively, not as words or answers on a test or essays, but rather functionally. Can you perform? Can you do the task? Can you be a geographer? Can you fly a plane? Now, in some cases, it's really obvious whether you can be successful or not. Take flying a plane, right? You get in a plane, you start up it's a motorcycle. I don't know, I'm not a pilot. You start up the plane, push the throttle forward, you go flying. If you stay in the air, you're a pilot. If you crash, you're not. But, you know, and we prefer to do that in a simulator. That's why we use a simulator. It's interesting, isn't it? The same immersive environment of the simulator that teaches us is also the immersive environment that can be used to assess us. Are you a good pilot? Did you crash the simulator? Right? And that's actually a pretty good way to judge. Are you a good brain surgeon? Exactly the same standard of evaluation. Exactly the same. If you want to know whether a person is a good brain surgeon, you do not ask, do you know this, do you know this, do you know this? You do not even say, can you cut this line? Can you remove that tissue? Right? The test of whether somebody is a good brain surgeon is the patient lives, the patient dies. Right? Patient lives, you're a brain surgeon. Yay! Patient dies, you're not. Again, we prefer that they do this on simulation. It used to be, I mean, in medicine, people would learn on real patients, and they'd... Now, other disciplines, it's harder. What's a good historian? History happened, it didn't. Well, no, it's hard, right? There's no such thing as a historian simulator. But now, let's look at the environment in which we immerse a historian to teach them. And I talked about that earlier. We have them play games. We have them join networks of historians and talk about history. We have them create historical artifacts and use historical artifacts. All of these things, this network behavior, right? And that's how a person becomes a historian. How do you become a historian? You join a historical network. You watch other people be historians for a while, and then you try to do it. And at first you're not very good, and they might even laugh at you. What, you thought Napoleon was Dutch? You know. But over time you get better. You offer your artifacts, your paper, or your representation of history, your portrayal of Napoleon in a play. And over time, in this network, you become more and more accepted, right? The more accepted you are in the network of historians, the more you can say to the world, I am a historian. How do I know that I'm a historian? Because other people who are historians look at me, listen to my words, see how I perform, and agree I am a historian. My historical theories don't die. They live. My historical ideas don't die. They live. When I say something about Napoleon, other people pass it on to their friends. Sometimes they even put it in books. Sometimes other people quote it. You see what I mean? So, to generalize, how do we recognize when somebody has entered a certain neural state? How do we recognize when they have achieved the set of connections that constitutes knowledge of how to fly a plane, or how to be a brain surgeon, or how to be a historian? We can't go in and look at the neural connections directly, and even if we could, it wouldn't be very helpful. We can't just ask questions on a test, because that's very misleading. We look at their performance in a network. The system the network that we use to teach them is also the network we use to evaluate them. This is a really hard concept, isn't it? Because we want to just ask them a question. Do you know the capital of France? Yes, it's Paris. But then if you give them a ticket to Paris and they get on a plane and they go to Botswana, you know they didn't get it. It's the performance in the network. It's the overall performance. Okay. So that's one way of looking at success in a network. But what kind of network is successful? I mean, it's one thing to say, well, you should do things so that other people will listen to your words or other people will follow you. It's one thing to say, you know, you should be successful in a network, but what does that mean? How do you do that? Because, and I think we all see the case where you go to a party, right? And a party is like a network. There's a little network with a lot of alcohol. And people are talking to each other, making connections and mingling around and all of that. And some parties are good. There's a lot of conversation, a lot of activity. People are having fun, but not too much fun. Other parties are bad. You know, like grade 12 high school dances, at least in Canada, where all the boys are here and all the girls are there, and there's a DJ up there playing bad music from 1980. In a party, some people are good at being in a party. They come into the room, they're talking to people, they're mingling, they're having fun. Everybody wants to be with them and listening to what they say. Other people, me, not so good. They come into a party, they look around, they try to find the wall where all the boys are standing, and find the wall, sit by the wall, work on the computer. So we know intuitively, because we've learned this, right? Some networks are good, some networks are bad. We know intuitively we can perform in a network better, we can perform in a network worse. So the question is, what are the success factors here? What constitutes better performance? What constitutes worse performance in a network? Kind of a hard question, right? It's not a question you associate with learning typically, but you know, you go to your classroom, you say, well, this person's a good learner, this one, eh, not so much. Right? You know, as instructors, intuitively, some of the people are better, some of the people are worse. I look at a group of people and I see from various behaviors who's learning, who's not. What are those factors? Well, remember I defined learning as growth. Learning as the formation of connections. Learning as the creation of a network, where the network, the series of connections, is in the end knowledge. The success factors are those factors that will result in the growth of the best or the most reliable network. So, good learning results in good networks. Bad learning results in bad networks. Does that make sense? Yeah, this is pretty. What else is it going to need, right? Okay. So, what's a bad network? Well, I have an answer for that. The answer, in two words, cascade phenomena. What do I mean by that? A network is a dynamic system. It's doing things all the time. Input comes in, signals are sent back and forth, connections are made. Right, your brain right now, there are neurons going, right, sending signals back and forth. New connections are forming. If you're learning, new connections are forming. So that's a good network. Things are happening. It's growing, reshaping, adjusting, adapting. The opposite of that is a network where nothing happens. A dead network. There's no signals being sent. There's no movement happening. Right? No. And there's actually two kinds of dead network. There's one where no signals at all are happening. And there's another where there's too many signals happening. Just noise. Right? The sweet spot somewhere in the middle where there's signals but they don't overwhelm. Somebody who is autistic in certain ways, their sensory perception simply come in as noise. They can't interpret it. So how do we understand that in terms of networks? Here's another network to think of. A network of people in a town. And one person gets a disease. Ebola. Okay? And then that one person talks to another person. They get the disease. And then they get the disease. They get the disease. Then everybody in the town has the disease. And then everybody dies. Successful or not successful? Not very successful, right? That's known as a cascade phenomenon, where a defect in one node, in one entity in a network, propagates to every entity in the network, causing the network to stagnate and die. Diseases are a very obvious case. Here's another case. And it's very current. You see that tulip there? You might wonder, why did I put a tulip on a slide about cascade phenomena? I talk about using flowers to express meaning. The tulip represents the bubble phenomenon. The bubble phenomenon is when the price of something goes up and 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 then crashes. That's a cascade phenomenon. The tulip refers to the prices of tulip bulbs in Holland. And the years, it's in the 1700s. And tulips were rare at the time in Holland. They were imported from Turkey. But then they began to be more popular. And bulbs to grow the tulips out of began to be more prized, and the price kept going up until the price got to be ridiculous. People were paying, you know, the equivalent of a year's salary for one tulip bulb, and they were speculating, they were investing. Right? You buy the tulip bulb today, sell it next week, make money. Sounds familiar? Right? It's a cascade phenomenon. Everybody wanted tulips. A market works when some people want tulips and some people don't. And where the supply of tulips is roughly proportional to the demand for tulips. But if everybody wants tulips, there can never be enough tulip bulbs, and the price goes through the roof until people realize it's ridiculous to want tulip bulbs, and then everybody doesn't want them. The world economic crisis that we're talking about is another one of those bubble phenomena. It is a network that is broken. Everybody speculated on real estate. And they borrowed money because they always figured they would make a profit on real estate. And then at a certain point, people realized, this is stupid. And then the demand for real estate fell. And the people who borrowed money on real estate went broke. And the banks who loaned them the money for real estate were now in trouble. And so you and me and the rest of the taxpayers have to pay off the banks. Yeah. Like I said, it's a broken network. Right? It says, we who have no money have to pay extra so that the banks survive. Anyhow. Underlying what's happening here is in a cascade phenomenon, a signal proceeds too rapidly without anything to slow it down. And it doesn't matter what the signal is. It could be a disease. It could be wanting to buy tulips. It could be being interested in Justin Bieber. It could be tourist guy or a meme, right? It doesn't matter what it is. But if it propagates through society, then eventually you will result in a cascade phenomenon which is dangerous to the health of that network and which kills the network. And we've seen in history this happen over and over. Fascism, an idea that when it cascades through a network, destroys the network. Ebola, same sort of thing. In a power network, a power grid. In North America, not too long ago, the entire eastern part of North America went into a blackout. And it's because the power surge went from place to place to place to place, and there was no way to stop it. It just propagated. There was a cascade phenomenon of a power surge, and the entire network came crashing down. And the entire eastern half of North America went without power for 8 to 12 hours. So, an effective network, a reliable network, is one where the signals do not propagate immediately throughout the entire network. You need to slow them down a bit. So, how do you create a network that allows signals, but which slows them down so that they don't eventually kill the network? How do you, in other words, maintain that dynamic, active state of a network? My answer, could be wrong, but I don't think it is to look at the structure of a network. Here's one structure, one type of network. It's a tree structure, or as you see in this diagram here, it looks like a hub and spoke network. And this is a very typical structure of the network. A lot of societies are organized this way. You have bosses in the middle and then all the workers around, right? And the bosses interact with each other and they tell all the workers what to do. Hub and spoke network. Broadcast networks are like this. The airline network is like this. All the airplanes go into big hubs and then little spokes. These are not reliable networks. But let's look at the properties first. The properties, something called a power law. A few entities have lots of connections. Most of the entities only have one or two. A hierarchy. It's a hierarchical structure, right? You have the big network at the top with lots of connections, and everything flows out to the little networks at the bottom. Right? This network is very susceptible to a cascade phenomenon. And the reason why it is because signals can be propagated through the entire network very quickly. Imagine one person in this network, one of the little green dots, gets a disease, Ebola. That gets connected to the central network. So that's one step. And now the person at the center has Ebola. And then the next step, everyone has Ebola. You see how in two steps, there may be a few, maybe three steps because you've got a couple of separate things, but very, very quickly, everybody has Ebola. The nodes at the center are too powerful. They send signals to too many other entities. So if the signal they send is in some way bad, if it's a disease, if it's a virus, if it's a meme, then the network very quickly can cascade and enter into failure. By contrast, here's a different network structure. It's a mesh. There's still some clusters, still some centering, right? But now, let's imagine one of the green dots gets Ebola. Well, they'll infect some people around them. But it's going to take more time, isn't it? A lot more time for the disease to spread. Because each node is connected only to a few other nodes. The distribution of connections is much more equitable. So there's no way for one entity in that network to spread something through the entire network right away. There's always a chance for it to be stopped, always a chance for some back propagation or feedback or correction to happen. This is a mesh structure network. So my thesis here, and this is my thesis, I think it's original to me, but there's probably somebody wrote about it somewhere. Nothing's ever original. Is that effective networks are mesh structure networks, where effective networks are networks that are able to learn, adapt, be dynamic, be reliable. And less effective networks are this tree structure or hub and spoke structure. So, when we build networks, we want to promote the creation of a mesh network rather than a tree structure. Make sense? Do you agree? Maybe think about it. Yeah, think about it. Because this is a controversial thesis. Think about what this says about your own organization, your own college, your own university, your own company. Your company is organized like this. Your university is organized like this. Well, we know the damage a bad president can do. My argument is it would be more reliable, more effective, if your university was organized like this. Your learning is organized like this. We teach people hierarchies. We teach people structures. There's the tree structure of language. There's the tree structure of biology. There's rules and principles that form a tree structure. Everything we teach is in this tree structure. But that means if you as a learner don't get that concept in the center, you don't get anything. But if we thought of knowledge as looking like this, it would be more reliable. So, in general, because remember, everything is communication, everything is teaching. In general, the way we organize our teaching, the way we organize our learning, should foster this mesh structure rather than this network structure. A better way to have this learning, and it's hard to do, would be to, we have right now, one person in the front and then everyone there, right? It would be better if we could create some sort of mesh. Now, the logistics make it difficult or impossible, right? You have to change the entire system to support that. It's very difficult. You can't just move from one to the other. But the first point is we want to recognize that this structure is where we want to be. This is what we want language to look like. This is what we want learning to look like. This is what we want society to look like. And then it will be more reliable, more effective, more able to learn, less likely to die. Well, how do you ensure that you get a mesh network instead of a tree network? Well, if we look at networks in nature, networks are limited by physical constraints. Look at these boats. This is just a bunch of boats on a harbor. I love this picture. This scene from like the air. This is a network. There are networks everywhere. And what are the properties of this network? See, boats can be words. Each boat is connected to some other boats, right? But we don't have one boat that is connected to all of the other boats. It's not possible, because boats take up too much space. So physical constraints mean that each boat can only be tied up to four or five other boats. So this network is equitable. It's also more reliable. If one boat sinks, it's not going to take down all the other boats with it. So the way we move from a tree network to a mesh network is to limit the number of connections that an individual entity can obtain. The thing is, many of the networks that we create are not physically limited. I'll give you one example, the economy. There is nothing in the economy that prevents all of the money being owned by one person. Well, okay, there are some constraints. But the economy allows one person to have a billion times more dollars than another person. In pure mathematics, again, we can imagine the mathematics of a network where one entity in the network has a billion more connections than other networks. The internet, again, does not have these physical constraints, not like boats. Google can have 2 billion users and 100 million connections to other sites. And then we have Joe Slobotnik, who has one user and nobody links to him. All right? Because there are no constraints. There's no limit on how many people can link to Google. So there's a difference here. A boat network is not scale-free. A boat network is constrained by physical constraints. But an internet or an economy or a network of ideas is scale-free. Nothing prevents one node from growing to excess. Nothing prevents the network from becoming unstable. All right, a long roundabout way, but we're getting there. I've talked about two concepts now. One concept was the idea of networks that are self-organizing. The other concept is the idea of networks that are stable, that do not cascade, that do not end up in network death. Both self-organization and stability are physical properties. Remember when we did the metronomes? It's just simple physics, right? And when we did the boat example, simple physics. The properties of objects. The physical properties of the network are what make the network stable. I've thought about these, and I've put a list of them up These are success criteria, physical success criteria for a network. Decentralize. Distribute. You don't need to memorize these. Disintermediate. Disaggregate. Disintegrate. Democratize. Dynamize and desegregate. Now, sorry about all the D words there. It's purely coincidence and nothing to do with the fact that my name is Downs. But the idea of all of these is you want to put some physical space between the entities in the network. And it's this physical space that slows everything down. It's the physical space that creates the challenge. It's the physical space that makes it harder for a signal to go from one person to the next to the next. It's the physical space that applies friction to the propagation of signals in a network. And it's friction that limits the possibility of a cascade phenomenon. And these are just all ways of creating this physical space. You can think of the practical implications. Look at how the internet was designed. The internet was originally intended to be a communication system for the United States military, corporations, and universities. And in the United States, they were very worried about nuclear war, as they should be. If the network was centralized, the entire communication system could be destroyed with one nuclear bomb, one terrorist attack. But if the network is distributed so that there are different hubs in different places, then it's very difficult to destroy the entire network, and that's why they designed it that way. As the famous saying goes, the network treats failure as a routing problem, right? If one of the nodes fails, you route around it. You cannot destroy the network by destroying one of the nodes. It's more robust, it's more reliable, less likely to be killed. One of the major principles, and this is important when we start talking about knowledge and understanding, is what I call the semantic principle, or the democratization of networks. And these are principles that lead to the creation of mesh networks and away from the creation of tree networks. Again, these principles are subject to empirical test. Right? I don't just invent them and pass them on to you from on high. They need to be tested by experience. There may be other principles. Some of these may be weaker. But here are the four principles: autonomy, diversity, openness, and interaction. By autonomy, what I mean is each individual in the network makes their own mind up what to do. They're not slaved to other networks. If you think about your brain, there's no neuron in your brain that tells all the other neurons what to do. Each neuron in your brain operates on its own. Marvin Minsky described this in his book, The Society of Mind, where he talked about individual agents in a society. And the idea is each agent does its own task in its own way according to its own set of priorities. In a society, each individual is autonomous. They have their own values, their own goals. They want to support their own family. They have their own ideals. In learning, again, we foster autonomy. So each student in a class has their own reason for being in the class. As an instructor, we recognize this. We know that they're not all in the class for the same reason. In a company, each person who comes to the office every day does that for a different reason. The people who go to work at McDonald's do not go to work because they want to bring the goodness of ground beef to the masses or whatever. They go because they want to get food or whatever. So that's the first principle, is autonomy. The second principle follows from that, and that's diversity. If you think about it, diversity is essential for communication to function in a network. If everybody thinks exactly the same thing, nobody has anything to say. Network death is the end of diversity in a network. Everybody has ended up in the same dead state. Networks require diversity. They require different parts of the network to receive different kinds of input. The third principle is openness. There has to be the capacity to communicate in a network. If you shut down the communications channels, again, you've killed the communication, the network tends toward network death. The big problem with the star network isn't so much the star, it's that the little green dots can't communicate with each other. If you want this network to be more reliable, you make this network open so one little green dot can talk to another. That's one of the things that the internet has done in places like Egypt and Tunisia, where all the media was controlled at the center, and while that was the case, you could maintain a certain form of government, but as soon as people are able to talk to each other, you get a different form of government. The outcomes are very different when you increase openness. And then the fourth principle is interaction. And this is a hard principle to comprehend, because it's not simply the idea that entities communicate with each other. It's not simply the idea that society is a conversation. It's not simply the communication. But rather, it's the idea that what we know is the result of all of us communicating together rather than the individual messages that are sent from one person to another. It's the idea that the knowledge of a network is what we would call an emergent property of the network, rather than a property of one of the individuals of the network. How do I explain that? You have a TV, right? You have a television? You must. Or a computer screen, minimally. Okay? And your screen, if you look at it close enough, and you all know this, your screen is composed of many individual pixels, little points of light. Right? And on your screen, let's say, is a picture of Richard Nixon. So you're sitting there in your living room, your television is on, little points of light are all on, you look at that, and you say, hey, that's a picture of Richard Nixon. Right? How did that get there? Is each little pixel a little tiny picture of Richard Nixon? Well, no. There's a red pixel, a blue pixel, an orange pixel, a green pixel, right? We don't have a million little tiny pictures of Richard Nixon. Each pixel is doing its own thing. Each pixel is autonomous, connected with the other pixels, but just because one pixel is green doesn't mean they all have to be green. If all of your pixels are green, your screen has died, you have to throw out your TV. So, where does the image of Richard Nixon come from on the television? It's like magic. And there's two ways to look at it. The first way, we talked about the interactivity, it comes from the organization of the pixels. We say there's a picture of Richard Nixon on the screen because the pixels are organized in a certain way. That's exactly the same as when I say you have knowledge because of the connections in your mind. That's exactly the same thing that I'm saying as I'm saying when I say the organization of the pixels produces a picture of Richard Nixon. It's a picture of Richard Nixon not because of the property of any individual pixel, but because of all the way they all work together. When we talk about the communication between the pixels now, one pixel talking to another, they are not talking about Richard Nixon, are they? One pixel says to the other, "I'm red." And the other pixel says, "I'm yellow." And the other pixel says, "Well, if you're red and you're yellow, I'm going to be blue." And another pixel says, "Yeah, I like blue. I'm going to be blue too." Right? And imagine the social organization of pixels. What kind of television would it be if there was one head pixel? Head pixel says, "I'm blue." And all of you are going to be blue too. Well, that wouldn't work. Imagine another organization where there's one head pixel that says, "I'm blue, and you're red, and you're yellow, and you're green, and you're red, and you're yellow." Well, that wouldn't work either, because pixels aren't smart enough to do that. So, the knowledge of the television screen is completely distinct from the knowledge of the individual pixels. In the traditional tree network, the knowledge is passed on, "I'm blue, you're blue, you're blue, you're blue, you're blue." It's a hierarchical passing on of knowledge, and we think of one individual, one pixel, as having the vision that will inform everyone else. You can just imagine a company that you work for, right? Where the president has the vision and everybody else in the company will have the vision. That's like having one pixel in your TV tell every other pixel what color it should be. The principle of interactivity means that the picture on the TV screen is not contained in any individual pixel, but is created through the interactivity of all the pixels together. The knowledge of the network is greater than the knowledge of any individual entity in the network. It's an important principle to recognize, because we are very often prone to confuse what the network knows with what the signals are that we send from one person to another person. Okay, so those are the principles. I want to emphasize and underline that these are not simply abstract principles. Rather, these principles taken together constitute a connectivist methodology and pedagogy. And they represent a shift in values and control. And they represent a means to achieving agility and stability. And they're not simply cognitive principles. They're not simply about content, but they should inform all of the practices of the organization, whether it's a learning organization or a tequila brewing organization or whatever. Sorry, I was in a tequila factory recently. And so it's the idea of network democracy. Each node is self-governing. Nodes are encouraged to have different states. There's an unhindered movement of signals between nodes and nodes between networks. And knowledge and learning are emergent phenomena. They result from the connections of nodes. So these are the principles in a little more detail, and I've already lingered on them. And that leads us to our connectivist pedagogy. And I don't have a whole lot of time left, but I want you to think now not about how you would teach other people, but about yourselves as learners, how you teach yourself. And this brings us full circle to the sort of message that I wanted to bring out in my opening keynote address on Monday. Because there I talked about the objectives of the organization, the objectives of the seminar, and talked about how the connectivist principles support that objective. Now I want to talk about your individual learning objectives and how meeting those objectives also describes a pedagogy that can be applied to students for whom you're writing curriculum. So we began with a very traditional learning management system. We looked at the aggregation. We looked at complex knowledge. We looked at chaos and synchronicity. And we looked at the idea that connectivist pedagogy is a pedagogy of engagement, of interaction, that there's no body of knowledge, but rather the knowledge is just like the ball in the soccer game. In the connectivist course, there's no curriculum to remember, no particular place to go to. It's not everybody doing the same thing, but everybody doing different things. And that's true of your learning too. In your learning, there are three major elements that I'm sure you will find, have probably already found through experience, that support your learning. And I talk about them as interaction, usability, and relevance. Interaction is the simple act of connecting with other people. When we are learning, the way we learn is we connect with other people. We want the human contact, whether it's in person or online, and we want to know what other people know. Well, how do you build this interaction? As adult learners, you build your own interaction network, right? Instead of focusing on the content of what you're trying to learn, you try to find people who know the things that you need to know. You connect with people who have the same interest that you have. There's that Hebbian association again. You connect to people, not objects. And you create this environment of connections that suits you best. Each individual, each of you, have your own network of friends. And we wouldn't take your friends and make them her friends. It wouldn't even make sense to contemplate that, right? Everybody has their own network of friends, and you create that network to serve your own interests and not the interests of the content or something else. You create an environment, a place to write, a place to send messages, like on the phone, in the front row, or on your computer, You meet with friends, connect with them perhaps at a bar or a tavern or in a restaurant or on a sports field or online at a website. And if you're learning for yourself the connectivist way, if interactions are not available, you create them for yourself. If you're at a lecture like this where it's been structured as a tree, you draw the line between those green dots and you communicate with each other even during the talk. You can always tell a room full of learners as opposed to a room full of people who are just listening, because the room full of learners is interacting with each other. And it's interesting for me to sit here and watch. And I'm not just talking about using the phone, but I look at people looking at each other and raising your eyebrows or making small gestures or perhaps a little comment, and I see that there is interaction happening. And if you are all distributed, if I was an instructor looking for connectivist ways people learn, I'd be looking for that back channel. If there's no official discussion created, a connectivist learner will create the discussion for themselves. If you're in a course, maybe it's a training course or whatever, and they haven't provided any communication channel, you create your own communication channel. You speak quietly with each other in the back corner. You might set up a place online, like a Ning or a Wiki or a Google Doc. You create your own connection. You use back channels. A back channel is a conversation that takes place away from the official channel. You set up private lists, your email account, you might use hashtags. All of this is intended to create this mesh network in place of the hierarchical network. So that's the first element. The second element is usability, which to my mind consists of two major factors: consistency and simplicity. And if you look at me and look at the way I learn and the way I talk about learning, I emphasize these over and over. Simple things, simple mechanisms, simple physical principles. Wax on, wax off. Simple principles of association. Consistency is the repetition that provides or creates connections. And the simplicity is the understanding that complexity will come from the creation of networks of these simple connections. How do you do that? As a learner, you organize your knowledge, you reinterpret your knowledge, you use your own vocabularies, you draw your own generalizations. A connectivist learner would take a long session like this and write a 5-sentence post to summarize it and put it in their blog. They'd simplify radically. And it's not because you can capture everything in 5 sentences. It's because the act of taking something complex and making it simple creates a view or a perspective. A connectivist learner takes charge of their own knowledge management system. All of you probably work in environments where there is a learning management system. Maybe there's an intranet with corporate documents and procedures, etc. A connectivist learner will reorganize that for themselves. Now, you can't go in and change the institutional system, but what you can do is create your own web page with a link to all the official documents so that you have a very easy access to it. What you can do is create your own database of resources on a website like Delicious or in Google Docs, in their spreadsheet, or any of a number of other services. The idea here is that you manage your own information your own way. And instead of a centralized system, you manage your information such that the information you need is where you want it. That's how Grasshopper was created. Grasshopper responded to a very simple need. When I first started using Netscape, all of my bookmarks were in Netscape's bookmark file. And the only place that were useful is wherever Netscape was. I created Grasshopper and put my bookmarks online, so now they could be available anywhere I wanted. I made my own bookmark system to serve my own needs. If you're managing your information your own way, the connectivist way, you might do something like creating a blog on Blogger just to take notes. A bunch of you are taking notes, some of you with a pen and pencil, some of you with a computer. And the question is, how will these notes be useful to you in the future? The connectivist learner will know that if you want to do a search on your notes, they need to be in digital form. Because, you know, I started learning before we could use computers and learning. I've got a bookshelf full of class notes. And if I'm trying to find that one note about Heidegger, about when Heidegger talks about interrogation, it's very difficult. I have to always be attending to which book it's in, what shelf it's on, what page it's on. I keep detailed tables of contents and indexes. But if it's on a computer, I just do a search. Heidegger interrogation. There it is. That's another reason I created Grasshopper. I never lose my bookmarks. So, sorry if those of you were writing in your notebooks. I didn't mean to pick on you. Another thing, I mean, this is something I do. Oh, I don't have my keychain with me. I have a keychain. I see people do this too. You can tell the connectivist because they have a keychain. They have a USB drive on their keychain, and they synchronize their notes with their keychain. They always have their content with them. A more modern way people are doing that is using something like Dropbox, and they have Dropbox. Dropbox is just a way to synchronize your files across different computers. That's if you don't want to carry a keychain around. The problem with Dropbox, and the reason why I don't use it, is it requires too much bandwidth. But I have a keychain with a USB. I don't need Dropbox. The connectivist doesn't buy more and more media. Connectivist stores media online where it's free or cheap. Uses things like Internet Archives. Stores photos on Flickr, bookmarks on Delicious. Always have a backup, always have a second source, but store media where you can get it. Here's a little trick. Create a Gmail account and forward important emails to yourself. And that way you can search your email using Google Search. I wrote that back when Outlook search was terrible. Outlook search is improved now. Thunderbird search is still very bad. I don't know what the search is on your email system, but Google email search is pretty good. The third part, and I think the most important part, is relevance. Learning what you need to learn, when you need to learn it, and where you need to learn it. There's always going to be someone that tells you, you need to learn such and such because one day you're going to need that. And it never happens that you need that. And you can spend a lot of time learning what other people think you need to learn. And life is too short for that, and there are too many things to learn. So you need to focus on learning what works for you. The things that you are interested in, the things that will make your life better. You know, there used to be a saying among people who worked on the high seas, on old sailing ships, and they'd have to climb up in the rigging to hang sails. And the saying was, one hand for the ship, one hand for yourself. And what that meant was, when you're on these sailing ships, and you're up in the rigging, and the ship is swaying back and forth, and it's windy and it's rainy, you're always hanging on to something. One hand for yourself, and then the other hand for the ship. If you take the hand off to put both hands on the sail for the ship, you're going to fall. And I think that's a general principle. In learning, if you're in an organization, if you're in a university, a college, it doesn't matter. In a restaurant. I mean, I started in restaurants. One hand for yourself, one hand for the ship. I did my job in the restaurant. Absolutely. I was very good at it. But I also learned to cook. It wasn't part of my job. But I made sure that my learning was serving my own needs. There we go. Getting what you want. Maximize your sources. Maximize the places you can get information from. This is why I talked about content aggregation and RSS and all of that, because it allows me to get input from many different sources. It increases my connections to the rest of the network. I can pick and choose what I want from what's out there. I recommend using Google Reader. If you don't use Google Reader, you might want to think about it. And, you know, follow that up. Let me ask, how many of you use Google Reader? Okay. Keep your hands up. The rest of you, ask those guys how to use Google Reader. Seriously, do it. Filter ruthlessly. If you don't need some information, you don't need some content, get rid of it. I'm happiest when my email has no email. My email program has no emails in it. I try to get rid of files as much as I can. Content that I don't need. I could have in my office a whole wall full of administrative and policy documents, but I don't need them. If I never refer to them, why would I have them? You can get rid of things from your own storage because they will be available elsewhere. Oops. Don't just acquire and store things. Again, people acquire content, they acquire books, they acquire PDF documents, thinking that they'll get around to reading them. And they build these huge libraries. But instead, as information comes in, remix it, repurpose it, and store that. Store your own information rather than someone else's information. That way, when you do need it, you don't have to figure out what they were saying. It's something you wrote as a note to yourself. My newsletter is a series of notes that I write to myself to remember about articles that I've seen. So you think about it, think about what happened, right? I have all of this content coming in. I read an article. I write a short note summarizing the article and what I thought about it. I store it in a database. And then, just to keep myself honest, I share it in a newsletter. And now I have a stock of about 20,000 small, short content summaries of resources that are out there on the internet. I don't store the web page or the PDF. I just store what I want from that. And if I really need the original, well, it's still up there somewhere. It's easy to find. Most important is not to let someone else tell you what information you need. You know what you need, and you need to focus your own information needs to address that personal need. especially you want your information to come from an entire mesh of sources and not simply from official channels. So you make friends, you make contact, you get to know the person in the mailroom, you get to know the person who cleans the floors, you get to know the person who does the same job that you do but in another company or another institution. You build your own channels of communication so that when information comes and it's not going to come through an official source, you still receive it. In fact, I think of these often as more important than the official information. Most institutional email, I can just read and delete. I received a bunch of them while I was here. I received one this morning telling me that our office building will be closed all day. So I looked at it and then I deleted it. I don't need that anymore. So. You know? But I mean, this applies to your information consumption outside of your work environment too. Yeah, I read a newspaper, but a newspaper is this much of where I get my knowledge from. I learn about the world from a wide number of sources. I learn about what's happening in other countries from people who are in other countries rather than my local newspaper. Very important. Because if I listened to my newspaper and watched my TV, all I would know is that there's an election happening in Ontario and Paris Hilton is no longer popular. That would be what I know. So I need unofficial connections to get better knowledge of the world. And then I organize this and I share this, create project pages to manage my own work. You saw that in action in this seminar where I created a Google site to manage my information. And now I've got a way of organizing and managing and thinking about the topics of these presentations. I follow other people on Twitter, follow their RSS feeds. I follow their work on MySpace, or, well, not MySpace so much anymore, but on Facebook and Google+. Again, it's not because these are official channels of information, quite the opposite. It's because these are unofficial channels of information. They connect the dots between me and other people like me. They help me create my own personal network. And when access is denied, I demand access. I don't just allow that, oh, well, I can't access. You saw that as well. At the very beginning on Monday, I complained because there was no Twitter. That wasn't just me being hard to get along with. That was me managing my own information and making sure that I had access to relevant information when and where I needed it. And that's where I want to stop this presentation. There are some slides on openness and some slides on the role of the teacher, which you can be free to refer to in the future, but I think this is a good note to stop here. And on this note of using these connectivist principles first and foremost to manage your own learning. And you know, if I was going to make one final recommendation, that's probably where I would end. I would say, like, focus now more on how you learn. I know everybody is at this session to learn how to design curriculum and how to help other people learn. But it's more important to focus on how you learn and to immerse yourself in that activity, because that will eventually show up in the curriculum in other ways, and in unique ways, and ways that are more appropriate for you. And focusing on being a connectivist learner for yourself is probably going to have the most effect in the long-term design of curriculum and in your long-term pedagogy. So that's everything. Thank you for coming. I know it's been a very long day. I sincerely hope you found this interesting and educational. And for those of you who are online on Ed Radio, You one person, you. Thanks for being with us as well. Gracias. More?
Para el mensaje final.
Bueno, buenas tardes. El mensaje es para agradecer obviamente la presencia del doctor Stephen Downes, que nos estuvo acompañando en este simposio de la Cominaic, y hacer la entrega in the name of the National Association of Universities and Institutions of Higher Education, la Universidad de Valle de Temajac, this university, and Universidad de Guadalajara, otorgan la presente constancia a Stephen Downes por su participación en la conducción del taller How to Organize a Massive Open Online Course Technology Methods, Infrastructure and Theory. En el marco del cuarto simposio de la Comisión Nacional para la Innovación Curricular de la NUYES, Innovar para Trascender, celebrado en Zapopan, Jalisco, México, del 5 al 7 de septiembre de 2011. Stephen, thanks for all your kindness, thanks for sharing your flow of innovation, and thanks for being here with us in Guadalajara. Thanks.
¿Verdad?
Un mensaje nada más para que no se muevan de sus lugares. Van a pasar con hojas de evaluación del taller. Creo que ya se las pasaron, ¿verdad? Okay. Bueno, gracias.
Very good.